All right, it's time to begin our class this evening. We have some visitors with us, and certainly welcome them. I know several have already visited with them. For our visitors' sake, we are studying in James. You probably received some questions for 3 and 4. We've got a few things to deal with in chapter 2. They're short questions. It was meant to be brief. For everybody else that knows, I won't be here for a month, and we needed to do some type of survey and hopefully a faith-building class, and that's kind of what we're doing. And we will, Lord willing, wrap up, surprise, surprise, chapter 4 and 5 Sunday. And you may not believe it'll happen, but I promise you it will. I promise you. Because there's a lot of things we cannot cover and that we would like to, but we do have to cover some things here in chapter 2 and 3. And maybe if we have time, we will get into chapter 4. But it's good to be here, and we're going to deal with Rahab this evening. I think Sister Ruth brought up that she would like to know, what do we do with Ruth? She's a liar. How do you deal with that? Did God approve of her? Did he not? You see, we'll talk about that this evening, and hopefully you have a better insight. I think we have some ideas that will work, and maybe you also have some things you'd like to add to that as well that we can benefit from. So let's get prepared for class this evening. Before we begin, though, we'll have a word of prayer. Brother David Snyder, would you lead us in prayer, please? Amen. As a reminder, I know that it's been announced, but just remember, Bob and Larry will be picking up Romans chapter 9 and working your way through the end, Romans 9 through 16 for the auditorium class. So be ready in studying for that, okay? All right, so what about Rahab? You know, she certainly is held up as a faithful character. And we've already talked about the fact that there is an interesting dynamic here. You take a man like Abraham, and he's held up. And then you take this woman, Rahab. Now, we know she was a woman of faith, but guess what? Even James tells us or reminds us of her previous occupation, the Rahab the harlot. And I don't believe that he's, obviously, by inspiration, he's not doing it to be derogatory or nasty, but it is to serve a purpose. Because you have, on the social scale, two very different people. Abraham, a man of God, a patriarch of family, a man who served God well and before a foreign peoples at that. And then this woman whose occupation was harlotry. In fact, she wasn't of the people of God originally. She came from the foreign nations of which God says, because their sins are full, I'm going to destroy them. All right? So socially, they're completely incompatible. But on the other hand, they're both great examples of faith. Because here is a woman who understands that there is a Jehovah God. We recognize that she knows that this God is the powerful one, and he means business, and we will be destroyed. And I don't want mine, that is me and my family, to suffer like that. I accept that God over all the gods I've been supporting or whatever the case may be all my life. And so she sticks her neck out, and she's in grave danger if she does. And we know that we can see that in the story of Joshua in Joshua chapter 1, 2. All right, so now, before I answer anything, I want to ask the question, does Rahab lie about the spy? Sister Ruth says her head, and I agree with her. There's no way of circumventing that. You've got to make some spiritual, mental gymnastics all the way through the Scriptures to try to say, well, God, and if we do that, then if we justify her, then we certainly could justify somebody else's lie. We could have situation ethics all over the place, can't we? Well, the fact is, we can't deny the fact that she lied, all right? However, we have to reckon with it and understand it. And I think there's easy ways of doing that, or at least I should say, ways that are easy to discover. So before I answer anything, I'm going to throw it out to y'all. How would you answer her being an example of faith and a recognizable one to be used in this particular instance, though she was a liar? Why is she on the same plane as Abraham, though they're on opposite ends? Really, they're used, they're equal. They're great examples. Brother Prince, I can hear you. You're going to tell me.
She was seeking first God's kingdom of the Old Covenant.
Yeah. There's no question about that. I think there's elemental, well, this is very elemental. She was seeking, as Brother Prince said, the kingdom which God would establish. She was seeking something very uniquely different that was of the people of God. That at least the story, and that's also what is very important to understand. If you ever want to wonder why the nations around them had no excuse, as they had all of that time and they remembered what Jehovah had done for those people in Egypt, how many years had passed before Rahab?
40
years before those big events, right? And we understand that those great events were still in the minds of the people, all right? So that means they know there's something special about this God, right? Therefore, they have no excuse. Joe.
Can I just read a, just
go ahead.
A verse or two of Joshua? Joshua 2. And here's what it said. Before the men were laid down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know the Lord has given you the land, and your terror is fallen on us, and all the inhabitants of the land of faith because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea when you came out of Egypt. And you did unto the kings of Amorite that were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our heart melted. Neither did there remain any courage for any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is in heaven above and in the earth beneath.
Mm-hmm.
She said that.
So the only reasonable conclusion is that all of the peoples of the land needed to repent. And she did. She understood that we are not right and your God is the God that's going to take care of that. He's going to take care of that. He's going to finally punish that evil, and she recognized that and she was not going to buck against it. Now, what do we deal with her in regards to her lie? As Brother Prince said, she certainly was seeking something. But we do have to recognize that she had, again, a faith that was in work. In other words, in process. See, a lot of times when we think about faith, we think of it in absolute terms. She either has it or she doesn't, or they have it and they don't, etc., right? When we think of Abraham, well, here he is. He starts right out of the chute of as a man of faith in our eyes because he gets up and leaves the land which God tells him to leave and goes to a land which God didn't even tell him immediately where it would be, right? A man of strong faith, all right? Rahab here is a foreigner, number one. Number two, she's not of the people of the book, though as Joe's pointed out in text, she's understood who they are, and God has not left himself without evidence, without knowledge, right? They know that he is there, and they know his promises. As Brother Prince said, she was seeking something that was very real. But that doesn't mean that she's up here in her faith. Think of it in these terms. If someone comes to the gospel of Jesus Christ, and they have been a hopeless drunkard, a wife beater, maybe a compilation of some things. They're just terrible. And maybe they spent 10, 15, 20 years in that state. But yet they are penitent. Where's their faith exactly? How high is it? I mean, certainly it's great and it's glorious that God's going to save them, right? Because they obey the gospel. But where are they at in terms of their faith? Is it a very strong one yet? No. And just think about it. If they already had addictions, how challenging would that be to still overcome? What if those things were still pulls, and they likely are? And do you think that this crass person with a foul tongue and maybe a violent attitude and actions are going to automatically just forget all of that and walk away? That may not rear its ugly head again? So here's the deal. God can recognize a person in their faithful attitude and desire to please Him who is lacking in a completeness or a fullness. I know I've used this illustration before, but remember, Jesus talks to the man who is concerned and doubting about whether Jesus can actually perform a task, and he says plainly, I have belief, but help my unbelief or disbelief, right? We've been talking about Abraham's steps, right? And so his missteps. And here he goes down to Egypt. Who told him to go down there in Genesis 12? Nobody. He didn't ask God about it. And what did he get himself into? A mess. He does it again in Genesis 20, and he don't even leave the land, does he? Doesn't he? What about the story with him and Hagar? There are problems even in his faith. And here is a man who is a faithful before God, and he's recognized as such, and yet we can know that it is possible for us to not be as faithful as we should be at times if we, again, do not pay attention, and we need to repent from that. And how much more so a lady like her who is just starting out, right? And that God can understand that she needs to grow in her appreciation of what it means to be faithful to God in every way and to be righteous. And so her lying wasn't held up as an example of good work or good works, but rather her understanding, and that's what the text that Joel just read for us brings out, that God is the one true God and He deserves to be respected and revered, right? That's exactly why. Remember the story of Tamar and Judah in Genesis 38. Let's just go over there real quick. I think this also helps inform us that we need to appreciate the fact that not every action of any person of God or any faithful person in the Bible is to be commended. Are we going to say, for instance, polygamy was something that was held up as a good thing? Was David commended for the wives or Solomon that they had? No. For that matter, how did that serve Hannah's husband, right? He had this struggle between, and it didn't serve him well. You know, we know that Jacob was tricked, but it still was a problem, wasn't it? Well, here you have a story of a woman who certainly, to no fault of her own, is put in a predicament, isn't she? She has a vile husband, and then she gets the vile brother, and God deals with both of them. And then she's promised the third one, the third son, but Judah's not going to commit. He's going to withhold from her. So she takes matters into her own hands, doesn't she? So what is said by the end of the story? When Judah realizes he has been the partner of her, thinking he had went to a prostitute and that she had went out again just committing the crime or the crime of prostitution, when actually she was trying to preserve the family heritage and to have a husband and have a child, right? And guess what? What does Judah say in verse 26? Right. She is more righteous than I, inasmuch as she did not give her to my son, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not have relations with her again. So here's the deal. What she did was not right. God would not commend that. Obviously, though that is the case, notice how God uses that relationship to bring about the Christ. Remember the son she has, Perez, and how that brought us to Christ, right? Yet, Judah could recognize, and this is part of the maturing or the growth of this man Judah, which we'll see later on if you read when we study in Genesis, that he will mature to the point that he recognizes his responsibilities and that he's willing to step out for his father and be a ransom for his brother. But here's the deal. Our righteousness, our faith needs to be in constant maturity and growth. And wherever we're at in that, it may be less than stellar, and there may be things that we do in that way that is not right. We need to be always ready with a penitent heart. And we can't take every example just because it's illustrated for us and say, aha, God approves that, because ultimately he called her a faithful woman. The fact of the matter is she was ultimately a faithful woman, but she had a lot to learn, didn't she? She would have to a lot more to learn, though we don't read the rest of her story. Yet at the same time, we also know, just as Tamar's son, she would also be privileged to be part of the ancestry of Christ. All right? Any additions or questions or comments you want to that? Brother Prince. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that he would. Because these spies. Now, what would happen, Brother Prince? Here's the point that I would make from that. If we were going to say hypothetically, if she did this, God would find a way. That's part I do know. God's going to make sure his people who are faithful to him are going to get exactly how he would have done it. I don't know. But he has it within his power. Now, if she would have done that, like you said, would she be considered a faithless person? Obviously, pointing them out would not have been very helpful. And we might have to argue she would have been, right? That they would have been something she lacked. But she was asked to take care of them. She asked them to make sure that in the destruction of the city, that her family would be spared. And then they gave her special instructions on how that would work. That much I do know. Anybody else? Brother Snyder. I'll get you, Ruth.
James 2 is about people's faith, and faith is not going to save us by itself. We have
right.
to do works. Well, Rahab, she had faith, but she was not justified by her lie, but she was justified by the work she did by saving.
That's
Let
it.
Those two men down and saving them.
Right, right. Sister Ruth, was it? Yes.
I was just going to say, we have to remember that even though Rahab lied, God didn't condone her sin.
No.
Yeah.
No.
He doesn't condone sin, period.
Right, right. And I guess there's also the broader picture, and you probably have heard preachers talk about this, and there is some truth to that. It's more general. And that is, if you take into account the fact that there was a time in which, you know, man was in the process of learning the story of redemption as God would unfold that and knew that the final promise would come through the Son, that he had great patience and endurance. So these old stories where we find things like polygamy, like the incest that we find, not that any of that would be approved or the lies, you know, eventually that would come to an end, that those things that were done before, for the time being, God was patient. He was enduring. He was persevering with the people. Why? He's long-suffering because 2 Peter 3:9 says that. He desires all of us to come to repentance. And that would be any less true for them either, right? So I think we can conclude that at the most. Anything else? Brother Prince.
Sometimes you're violating a command any which way you can. Kind of the impression I get is when it comes to a moral thing, it's a lot harder.
Yeah.
Matthew chapter 12, where it says, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. If you're on your way to services, maybe you're even a preacher, and you see somebody, you know, you're out in the middle of nowhere, and somebody, it's a true emergency, 911 emergency.
Right.
Somebody's got to help.
Right.
So you might have to say, well, I'm supposed to be preaching tonight, but I may not be able to make it. You stop me, help the person.
Good point. what I did. I may have touched it. That is a good point. As Brother Prince points out, there could be circumstances in which, as we understand that God desires mercy over sacrifice, in other words, that should be a primary motivator. That is an illustration. If a preacher was on his way to services and was required to be teaching or preaching, and this emergency arose, and he needed to take care of that, he needed to take care of that instead of making sure he's there on time, right? Good point. And so that we understand that there are things that take priority, right? Things that must be important first. Okay, anything else? Correct.
And with what we see just in that story alone of when she did this with the spies, I mean, here whenever I always go through this story, it's, I mean, the lies really, in comparison to her lifestyle, very minimal.
Yeah.
And yet, the scriptures shed some light on the fact that she did say what she said, but going back to how you mentioned, I mean, she knew of the God of Israel, but didn't know the God of Israel.
Correct.
And in my mind, that's just, again, going back to the progression of one's faith. Whenever you go back and see a lot of these historical characters, you see that Jacob was a deceiver. You see that Noah had gotten drunk. I mean, there was very few who don't get that light cast on them, such as Joseph, who seemed to be pretty outstanding and perfect in many ways. But yet you get always into my connection is because of what she did, it led to what ended up coming, you know, through the Messiah. But man, she's just like us.
Yeah.
And little do we ever have ourselves do what we need to do in the beginning when we first come to know of the God that we need to be submitting ourselves to. Let's just hope that she got it figured out down
good
the road,
point.
Right? So I'm with you on that. That was the beginning of her life and
right.
This God that she feared.
I'm glad you brought up Jacob, the deceiver. Actually, because we'll eventually get to that study when I get back, that whole family was messed up. You had partiality that led to sin. Oh, the partiality itself, I think, was sin, but I mean, it devastated that family. Oh, don't you know that Isaac probably, well, here he thought he was going to die, and he lives much, many more years. Don't you know that Isaac had to have thought, only if I hadn't have thought more of Esau than Isaac, and just only if I would have encouraged my wife to consider that problem as well. When you look at what they did in the process of the deception and the sin, I don't know how you can say that Rahab was worse. And these are people of God. These are the people, as we say, of the book. And they were the people who had been given the promise and been told the promise, even at birth of those sons. So again, good point. Stellar example.
Yeah. These guys are her lifeboat.
Right.
The city's about to get destroyed, and she's going to be a part of that city. And
right.
It's time to get out of here because I know it's about. I would have,
right.
Being honest with that, I probably would have done something very like that.
Right. And not to practice situation ethics or condone it. Consider this. We're seeing this written on the pages that happened all those years ago. This happened in her moment of time for her. This wasn't like she had a whole bunch of time to plan this out well. And you can just imagine the challenges. Brother Miller.
Well, you notice by reading the verse, he did not condone the evil she did.
Right.
He condoned what she did to save his people as righteousness.
Yeah.
Her works were considered righteous.
Right. Right. And so, again, go ahead, Joe.
Just two things we can remember about her. She was a harlot, and she hid the spies. And that's...
Yeah. Yeah. So, again, I think there's a progression of faith that we must always appreciate. And let me also add this, just like we talked about with Jacob and his maturity, think about when he didn't arrive at it even at one time. Think about the mistakes he made even as an old man. We forget the fact he was in his late 70s when he got married. Then he brings the kids back, and what does he do? He parks them right next to a foreign city. He had no business being there. And he didn't go back to the traditional lands that his father had went down south around Hebron. No, he parks near Shechem, you know? And guess what he does? Now he's got two sons that are going to kill the people and not keep the agreement. He has a daughter that goes in to check out the things and becomes again, violated and so on and so forth. So you see all the problems, and he didn't deal with it all immediately. And by the way, he didn't learn well because he also played the game that his parents did as far as favorites. Now, I'm not arguing that those sons were righteous, the ones that had sold their brother into slavery. However, he had a role to play in that problem. Okay? Keep that in mind. These are the people of God. So progression of faith is always important. Just as I've illustrated, if you ever know anybody who obeyed the gospel, very tender in the faith, interested in the word, and yet they have things that they have not learned well yet, and you recognize things they do wrong. Or they have to be told tenderly, but you realize they're not exactly who they should be. Maybe they haven't recognized everything they should. And so they step out, right? What do we do? What are you doing? Get in line. No. You tenderly teach them. And I would argue Rahab would be of that kind. We don't read the rest, but I'm sure she would have learned much more once she was with the people of God. And her faith would be enriched and it would grow even more. God thought well enough of her to allow her to be a part of the Christ ancestry, Jesus ancestry. That much we do know as well. All right, I knew we'd spend some time, wouldn't be able to get deep into three. We're going to see how far we can go. All right, if you were to sum up chapter 3, before you even really jump into the questions, though I didn't give them to you earlier, how would you sum this chapter up? This is the shorter one of James. How would you sum it up? Watch your tongue. Good job, James. Joe, excuse me, James. watch your tongue. Good job. Good deal. How many should be teachers? Because he says many not, right? Few. All right. Here's something that, as I think about it, and I could be wrong. You guys can correct me in this. When he says that not many of you be teachers, is he talking about, for instance, a person who's not necessarily a teacher on a regular basis, necessarily like I'm doing, standing before you, but has an opportunity to tell their neighbor or their friend or their family what they need to do to be saved? Is there really a distinction here? I think there is. I think there's a lot of difference here.
It says, we shall receive.
Right. So I really do believe he's talking about me as an example. And that is very scary at times to think about. To be quite frank with you, it's too easy to step out. Now, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be guarding your tongue. And I'm not arguing that the text doesn't require all of us to be doing that. But if you're not teaching people regularly, understand that I don't know that that's what he's saying here. I think that he is saying to those who are regularly imparting the truth, and I don't mean just necessarily in this public setting, but generally as a teacher, a man like Apostle or Apollos who is out eloquently teaching the word, and James, for instance, etc., that if you are charged with the word, like Timothy, to be ready in season and out of season, reprove, rebuke, exhort, you need to guard your tongue. And that class of people, for no better way of putting it, needs to be few, is what he says. Thoughts, comments, objections. Go ahead.
I originally said no when you asked the question. I'm like, well, I'm still going to stick to why I thought no, because I feel that there is a responsibility within each and every one of us that you have to be as a workman, there's no need to be ashamed of handling the word of truth. So it's on me, even though if I'm not a teacher as you are, it's on me that if I'm going to be sharing the word with somebody, I need to be doing it accurately and not just taking what the preacher said, because there's a lot of preachers who make right. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of preachers even that are televised, glamorized in many different ways that we especially see today in our culture, that we're just taking their word for it, and that's on me. And what I say to my neighbor, what I say to my family member, and just regurgitating something that I don't know for certain came from this, but it came from the God who said it, I'm a teacher in that moment, and I think I'm going to be judged for that. That's what I've always taken.
And I don't necessarily say you're wrong, because like I said, I've looked at it, and I thought, okay, don't let many of us be teachers, and yet, what do I teach a lot of times here? What have I been teaching you, Jerry? You'd be an evangelizer, right? I'm not saying you have to know everything, but right. I'm saying, hey, we all have a part to play, and it's kind of like what you're saying. But then I go back and it says, but then James says it very plainly, don't let many. So then I said, well, that's not mine. I'll step back from this. And so all of a sudden, we're looking for somebody to go out and help teach the gospel or tell their friends or let's have a Bible study. Well, wait a minute. We learned from James we don't need to have many of us teachers. Let's figure out how many of us can be. Let's make sure that's a smaller number, and let's have everybody else back away. You see, that's the only challenge I have with it. But I understand what you're saying clearly. So I would struggle with that. I agree. Brother Prince.
Acts 13, verse 1, said there in the church that was at Antioch, there were certain prophets and teachers. It seems to have been a position in the church.
Yeah.
Where, like, 1 Corinthians 12:29, it says, all are not teachers, are they?
True.
We're all to be teaching to what extent that we can.
True. Right.
And I think he's talking about the teacher or the teachers here.
Could be. And as you're saying, Brother Prince, to piggyback off of that, to harmonize, you know, Paul will say in Ephesians 4, as he begins in verse 11, and he talks about the different classes, the apostles, prophets, teachers, etc. Obviously, these persons would take care of edifying or building up the majority to do whatever ministering that they would need to do. And then if I would take 1 Corinthians 14, verse 1, in account, and Paul would tell them that, hey, you know, desire the good gifts earlier, and he says, desire prophesying above all. Well, we've mentioned that before, and that involves teaching. That's the point. It wasn't because it was, you know, one of those very, one of those gifts that everybody would desire. Obviously, tongues was one of them they really wanted, but he says, no, you desire prophesying. Because the main reason prophecy was most important, because it was teaching the Word of God, revealing it. So, again, he's saying that not all, I would argue in that text, he's implying that not all have it. That he's saying desire it. But that didn't necessarily, by the way, imply that the Lord would make sure that you had that gift. So, maybe, again, there's something to be said. Go ahead.
So what would you say would be the stumble?
Yeah, go ahead. Well, his tongue would be a very dangerous thing. If he's regularly teaching, he's got to be very careful to be guarded with the Word. You know, there's things that I will tell, as I've done in the class, as we've done this evening, that I'm not quite certain about, but I don't need to be so dogmatic and certain about if I don't know. So I express that so that they have an opportunity, whoever the student is, to examine that for themselves. Don't believe it because I said it. But likewise, I need to be very careful with the text. I think that's really what Paul is saying. Whatever the Word says, make sure you understand it well. You know, it's kind of like what I was told many years before. You make sure you know your subject before you teach it, because it's not going to do anybody well if you have a general knowledge of what you're going to teach, and you can't really edify anybody, right? So I need to make sure I know for certain. And I have made the mistake of teaching something that I wasn't so clear on, and I ended up getting myself in deeper and hotter water. That's no good. I don't know that that's the case. Although we will see in James, there would be a pride factor that will be a challenge, obviously, for any teacher. You get an audience. You know, if this is, as we say, my gig, and more people want to come and hear it, like you were talking about those evangelists or preachers that have a charisma, it's too easy to get caught up in that, because this would be my thing, and I would be able to influence people, and before I know it, I'm caught up in that and not here. And I think that maybe James would be addressing people that would get to that point and they would forget themselves or forget what they need to be doing.
I think there's a reason why he pointed this out. Because we're all taught to teach the world about God.
Right.
But your teachers have got to be sure they're right.
Right, yeah.
Otherwise, he wouldn't have made a point of the teachers having behavior judgment.
Right. The stumbling in many ways, as you asked about stumbling, it just says many. It doesn't really identify those. And I suppose it would even happen in the salvation. Sadly, I've known preachers who have really went way out, away from what they originally taught about the plan of salvation, what God has taught. So it's even possible in the simple things. But more often, I've seen people in their way stumble in these things that are maybe more complicated, more challenging, and they have some soapbox to work with, and they're working on that soapbox, and they have got the attention, and they have people that are enraptured with them, and they keep working that scene, as it were, and obviously causing more people to stumble and trip along the way. Correct. Oh, yeah, yeah. And I guess you could also argue, you know, besides the pride, we could also have a situation where because we were not careful, not necessarily because we initiated it for pride's sake, but because we were negligent or careless in the word, then we could also stumble, all right? But again, I think pride's going to be an important part of this story, okay? He just does not tell us exactly what that would be. He just says simply, stumbling in many ways is very possible. And likewise, because of that, then he's also one who would by extension not bridle what? The whole body. That means what happens, and we learn the connectivity between faith and works when he says, when he starts off here with words and how they lead to actions. We're going to see that in the context. The words and the actions, how they are so important. What I say and what I do need to harmonize with one another. You know, some people do say things, but they don't act. You know, sometimes you hear the story of the preacher. He can preach one of the greatest lessons. He can cause people to come to the gospel. But what does his life look like? Be the opposite. Do as I say, not as I do. That's usually the traditional. And so we need to keep that in mind. I like I said, I would like to spend more time, but anything else anybody like? Brother Prince.
There's a place for men like the Timothys, Timothy in the Bible, to go traveling with an older preacher and be trained and such as that. But at the same time, Jesus did not begin his ministry until he was about 30 years of age.
Good point.
And some of these guys coming out of college, I've got a Bachelor of Biblical Studies degree, and they're young, early 20s, and they're not even qualified to be a deacon, and they think they're ready to start preaching for some large congregation, and they may have, you know, just fantastic speaking skills. They may have won all kind of trophies and some speech competitions and that kind of thing, and they may get those big jobs, but
yeah,
I think this verse is a warning to those that they may need some maturity and develop a skill the Jewish rabbis would learn a trade before they begin serving before their work as a rabbi.
Right. That may be the case. But what is the one primary thing that James tells us in chapter 3? What needs to prevail? Humility. Humility needs to be a constant, vigilant practice. We've got to discern. We've got to say, wait a minute, why am I saying what I'm saying? What does it matter? If what I am saying, if I can say for certain it's truth and show that it is so, and it can, by the way, edify. What does Paul say, 10:23? He says, what? Not all things are helpful, right? I mean, all things may be lawful, but not all things are helpful. Not all things are needful. I need to do the needful things, all right? All right, so I knew we didn't get through. Chances are, unless I go speeding through Sunday,